Colonel Hutchison, Reel 8. We'd like now to move on to the sort of that night's activities. And one of the things that you mentioned off tape, which we're just interrupted by, was the work of the 51st Highland Division in lifting the minefields. Could you tell us about that? What exactly was happening there?
Well, the minefields there had been laid by the 51st Division to protect their position, so they knew where they were. And when they lifted them, I don't know, but one assumes that they did it during the hours of darkness, because although we didn't start the advance until at first light, it was, I think, about 7 in the morning, something like that, that's how we did. And we formed up behind the third tanks were going to be on the right of this charge, and we were on the left. But I think to begin with, until they were through the minefields, I think we had to go just one up. In other words, my recollection is the third tank went through first, and then we went through next, and then pulled out alongside of them until we were through the minefield.
Was there a problem getting through the minefield? Because people talk about there being a sort of traffic jam, but
the first thing that seemed to slow us up was the first railway, which wasn't very far away. We got into a sort of rough line. We were supposed to be...
Now, hang on, before we go, I'll come back to that then. What about the bombardment and the RAF raid? What do you recall of that, the RAF raid?
That's two officers going over, because it didn't fly particularly high. And then, of course, once they started dropping the bombs, there was a horrific sort of store of dust thrown up, so that... And it was, quite an impressive noise, the thousand bombs dropping a lot of bombs through this corridor. But it must have been terrifying to be underneath it.
And was this at the same time as the artillery barrage, or was that following on from it?
No. The artillery barrage didn't start until we started. And so, in other words, the Lancers first, and then the artillery barrage, which we followed, and then we were going through quite a broad corridor of openish ground between a string of villages on the right and on the left. And they were being attacked, I think, by concentrations of medium artillery, but that was separate from the barrage. And we were supposed to see the barrage and to keep close up behind it. And the difficulty about to say was that when we got to the first railway, there was an embankment there. And it was quite a business. You couldn't just sort of drive across in line ahead, because there were places, you had to select places where you could get across, up the embankment and over. And by the time we got across the other side, we lost the barrage.
Was it just so steep that it was difficult to get over? Or was it that you were very vulnerable as you showed your underbelly as you went over the top?
One obviously would have been vulnerable, the underbellies, but it wasn't that. No, it was just a sheer difficulty. It wasn't all that difficult, but it just slowed things up a little bit, getting over the top and then forming up on the other side.
Were you coming under fire at all at this stage at the first row alone?
Well, we had the second commander of B Squadron was killed by a sniper going over the railway line, I understand. It was his first day in action. Well, fellow had been left out of battle for the first battle, called Raymond Chaffern. But I wasn't aware of being shot at. One was aware of German equipment by then, and a certain number of soldiers with hands up, that sort of thing. But one was intent about trying to keep in line.
Why was it so important to stay in line? Why was this regarded as so important to stay in line?
I suppose it's part of the drill for this operation. I think the idea was that they would get a sufficient weight of armour forward behind the barrage that they could then would have the power of being able to manoeuvre tactically once it had got beyond the second railway line.
Now, what happened between the first railway line and the second railway line?
Quite a lot, as far as we were concerned. We were on the, we were the front rank on the left, A squadron. We were on extreme left, and B squadron, John Gilmore's squadron, was to our right, and then the third tanks was to the right of that again. But one didn't see them. I was concentrating just on keeping in line as far as it was able to with them. With other members of the squadron. We fired our guns, machine guns, because we were moving, we weren't allowed to stop. And so we were firing our machine guns at any bit of cover, you know, keep potential enemies' heads down. But we passed a village called Kanye on the left, which had, in front of the village, there were fields and orchards with tall trees and hedges and that sort of thing. And we, although I wasn't aware of it until after we reached the second railway, we had several tanks brewed up from Canyon, about 88 millimetres, turned out. C Squadron, who were in reserve behind us, got even worse punishment, and that's when Chris Nichols was killed. But you heard about this fellow called Colonel von Luck, who came back from leave in Paris that morning to find this schmozzle, and he immediately took control of some anti-aircraft 88 millimeters and said, "You've got to bloody well shoot those tanks." And they said, "Well, we're anti-aircraft." They said, "If you don't, I'm going to shoot you." And so they leveled their guns and did fatal damage to us. And we were, you see, could do nothing about it at that stage. We couldn't see the guns anyway. They were camouflaged, and we were told we were moving. And so we've been well thinned out by the time we got across the second railway.
Was the second railway an obstruction as well? Was there an embankment there?
Not where I was. It was flat, and I just motored across it. There was a signal box there, I remember. Small signal box. And I motored across.
Now, had you held formation? I mean, were you still in line, the gaps or not? Had you managed to hold formation? And what about the barrage? You hadn't caught it up, obviously.
The barrage had disappeared by then. We'd lost. I think it had finished. It had reached the second railway, but it had done its job. I think they probably run out of ammunition.
Now, what happened then? Then you see,
we were then in open country. It sloped away gently in front of us. The ground. There was another village in front. Four. And to the left, there's another little village which is part of Cagny called Poirier, I think. Anyway, John Pearl and half the squadron continued on in front with B Squadron, John Gilmore's squadron. And I was told to protect the left flank with our two remaining troops. Four troops, Brownlee's troop, and another troop. And pretty soon, John Paul and his troops and the B squadron people came into trouble in front and really got stopped. And John Pearl had the tracks of his tank shot off, but not penetrated. And they managed to recover the thing later on in the day. And then the 23rd Hussars, who were a reserve regiment, came up through us. And they ran into trouble, you see, the same sort of trouble. And they were all mixed up with John Pearl and B squadron. And getting very confused.
How are you discharging your role on the left flank?
Well, we had plenty to do because I remember seeing a panther. At one stage, the Poirier village was a wall in front of it, an old, nice old Norman wall around the orchard. And I could see this thing blow a hole in the wall with its gun, so it could poke its gun through. And then we got onto it, and fortunately, before it did any damage to us, we blew it up with the 17 pounder, I think. Yes, I think it fixed it. And then the old guns and stuff were shooting at us, and we were shooting at them, and we cleaned up them, I think. But we lost some tanks, and where from, I don't know. In front, I think.
Do you mean in front of you on the left, or do you mean in front where Powell was?
Straight ahead, yeah.
Well, in front, on the left flank.
Yeah. I don't know whether the village of Four, with trees and hedges around it, quite a small hamlet, straight in front of us, whether it was ever properly cleared. And I think that the other half, A squadron, B squadron, of the 23rd side, tried to work around the right hand side of that. Anyway, I don't think it was ever cleared, and I think that was one of the troubles.
And that's where some of your casualties were originating from Four?
Yes, I don't know. But and then there were plenty more stuff further back, which later on in the day, when the next one time, came out, waddled out. I think there were some tigers there. Or were they panthers? Anyway, one or other, they were German tank, quite a few of them. Came out and came in closer to us and started swatting out. Well, we returned fire after swatting them, and our shells are bouncing off these bloody things. But we fortunately we had quite close liaison, I suppose at regimental level, with the RAF, and if you wanted support, you asked for lime juice, and if you had a sufficiently high priority, you got it quite quick. And there were these rocket-firing Typhoon fighters, and we got them help from them. This happened several times on different occasions. They were quite good and quite accurate. But by the middle of the day, I think one's aware that the Guards Armour Division had come up, and they were operating on our left. And I think they eventually took Cagny village, whether that day or not, I don't know. But
did that reduce the pressure on you?
Yes, I think so. But we were down to, or I was down to, my tank, I think, and four troop, Brownlee's troop.
He'd been lucky then, his troop.
And we were the remains of what was watching the left flank. But the trouble, and then some C squadron came and relieved us later in the day, for the simple reason we were running out of ammunition. And there was no question of getting ammunition trucks up.
You've been firing that much?
Yes, we've been firing. When I say running out of ammunition, I mean particularly 75mm shells or solid shot.
Now,
it's exactly the on a time scale, it's awfully difficult to remember what time. It was early in the evening by the time C Squadron, I think, took over from us, and we went back and concentrated somewhere behind the second railway line, but not that very far away. And the squadron, or eventually what was left of it, met up there. We had an armoured recovery vehicle at that time, which was a Sherman tank without a turret, and somehow that had recovered John Pearl's tank and got it back across the railway line. And he said to me, and I think probably quite rightly, look, there's no point in both you and I staying here. We only had about, I can't remember how many tanks we had, five or six or so.
It says six in your notes, yeah. Yes.
He said, I must take command. I'm going to take your tank. And you will take my tank, trackless tank, back towed by the ARB, they call it, this turretless vehicle. And so that's what I did through the night, being towed back across the battlefield, and arrived at the air echelon vehicle area, wherever that was, about dawn, I think. I don't remember. I suppose the tank then got a new set of tracks somewhere. So quite quickly, the ordnance people, I don't mean the regimental ordnance people, but the tank repair people, were quite quick in repairing tanks, or seemed to. We never seemed to be, after a battle, there never seemed to be a shortage of replacement tanks.
Was it repaired or replaced? Wouldn't you know?
A bit of both, I imagine. I don't know.
Now, that would mean, were you aware of the scale of casualties in the whole regiment, or just in your own squadron?
I think by the time I got back and got out of the tank, I was fairly exhausted, not only the day before, but of course the two previous days. I think I got into a slit trench and slept for most of that day, I think. There was nothing I could do.
So you missed the night bombing raid, or did you?
I didn't. That arrived. That happened during the night. But as when I surfaced that I'd heard of that damage, and I think then became aware of the extent of total casualties.
How did it affect you? I mean, you must have lost friends and...
Yeah. Well, John Pearl, of course.
He was killed next day in the morning.
The next day, yes, in the morning. But it wasn't until that evening that I heard. And, yes, and... certainly, the Yankee troop commander, Kenneth Matheson, he'd been killed. He'd been dehorsed and had been killed by the bombing raid. Yes, he was a close friend. And so that was sad.
Did it affect morale, either your own or the unit's?
They were nervous that the result of that battle and the two battles might have affected morale. And I remember Roscoe Harvey, the brigadier, coming around to the place where we concentrated and reformed and got reinforcements and spent the thick end of a week coming around and obviously inquiring about that. But close enough. I think morale was quite good.
Now, one other thing is, what was the wireless traffic like in a battle like that? Because you're on a regimental net, but what I was thinking is, surely in a line like that, surely everybody had something to say. And how did that... What was traffic like in the wireless?
I don't remember. But I have a feeling that, that everyone was so busy conducting their tanks and trying to maintain formation and firing by guns at any targets that came up or just spraying hedgerows and the like. But the men, just for a period, had been all that much wireless traffic.
So people weren't reporting in to Scott what was happening? That they were too busy dealing with it?
I think Scott must have been well aware of what was happening, because he must have seen the damage that was being done to C Squadron, which was even more severe than ours damage. I forget.
I can't remember the casualties, but they did have severe casualties.
We lost most of two true, I think. I suppose the left hand one. Maybe they were just, they must have been quite close to me.
The A troop officers who were killed that day, Lieutenant Forbes.
Yes.
Do you remember him?
No, Forbes was killed in the bombing raid.
And Spittle was wounded. Was it during this action that your... it wasn't during this action that your driver had performed badly. He'd been all right in this one, had he? Or had he already...
No, it was later than this.
Had he done all right in this...
But I think... perhaps I was unaware that he was losing his nerve. But it didn't actually... boil up until sometime during the next battle, during the breakout.
What signs were there that he was losing his nerve? I mean, what would you watch for in a man if you don't, you know?
He just, in effect, said to me, "I can't go on. I just can't go on."
He hadn't said that yet, though.
No.
But what signs was he showing before?
None. Yeah, I wasn't aware of it until he came up with it. And I sort of saw that he was in a hopeless state.
I'll come back to him for the break. Now, on the 19th of July, that's the next day, that's when Pearl was killed. You weren't involved, you only rejoined them in...
No, it was the one day in the whole campaign that I wasn't with the squadron. So it happened.
And what... The next thing is they went... I think they went back to Demouville and then... to Arden Abbey. for a rest period. This is probably when the brigadier joined them.
No. We went back to Neverville. That's where I fell into a slit trench and slept, I think. But then we went back north of Caen to a place, a ruined abbey called the Abbey des Ardennes, or something like. We were there for about a week, approximately, refitting and being reinforced. And it was there that the brigadier came up and was trying to find out.
Now, what about the brigadier? Let's just talk about him. What about Roscoe Harvey? He's quite a well-known officer. What was he like?
Well, I think how good a soldier he was. I think he was quite a good soldier. Anyway, he commanded the brigade throughout the campaign. I think he got along very well with Pip Roberts. He was a cavalry soldier. Pip Roberts was a tank man. So they got on pretty well.
Did you see a lot of them, Roscoe Harvey, the brigadier?
No, not all that much. I suppose there wasn't the opportunities. During the campaign, he was busy, and so were we.
What about Roberts, Pip Roberts? I mean, how much of an influence was he? I mean, he was divisional, he was a general, major general. How much contact and influence do you think he had? He's got a good reputation, hasn't he?
I think he was a very experienced field commander, and I think he's a pretty good general. He was certainly highly regarded, I think, throughout the division. Didn't see a lot of him. I didn't know him. I didn't know him well, ever. He was only 37 at that time.
That was very young.
Of course, very young, wasn't it? He was commanding a squadron of tanks in the desert, I think, and then got quick promotion. And the last, he was a brigadier. And then he got command of the 11th Armored Division. When we were on the world, was it all, or before then? I think it was during, yes. I think, just less than a year before we went overseas.